From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Leah Fleming. Maynard Jackson left his mark on the city of Atlanta, the rest of America, and the rest of the world.
Pending reorganization of our city government will be designed to open wide the doors of City Hall.
Jackson served three terms as Atlanta's mayor. He's the first African-American to hold that post. A new documentary looks at his legacy. That's ahead this hour. But first, we talked about the history of a Southern staple, sweet tea. We asked you, how do you take your tea? Here are your first thoughts. Hector Amador wrote us on Facebook. He says, quote, "It's a very Southern thing. I grew up with iced tea, always unsweet. It wasn't until I moved to the South back in 94 that I've always had to ask for iced tea, no sugar, please. I've tried sweet tea before, but it seems a little too sweet for my taste. But I can see the appeal to people." Thank you for your comments. So how do you drink your tea? Sweetened or unsweetened? Well, you can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The Centers for Disease Control reported yesterday that someone has died because of the outbreak linked to romaine lettuce. It's the first death linked to this E. coli outbreak. The death was reported in California, but state and federal health officials did not immediately provide any other details. The CDC updated its numbers on the outbreak yesterday, revealing that 121 people have gotten sick in 25 states. At least 52 people have been hospitalized, including 14 with kidney failure. Consumers in Georgia and nationwide are being advised to avoid romaine lettuce because of the E. coli outbreak. I talked about the outbreak with Patricia Griffin. She's the chief of enteric diseases at the epidemiology branch at the CDC. Thanks for joining us today, Patricia.
So I'm glad to.
So how was E. coli first discovered, and what's its scientific name?
It's called Escherichia coli 0157H7, and it's one of the Shiga toxin-producing E. coli. And it was first discovered to be a pathogen by a joint investigation by CDC and several state health departments. There were two outbreaks separated by several months in 1982, and they were both at fast food restaurants, and the people developed a severe form of bloody diarrhea. They were really, really sick, and the hospitalization rate was high. And with the first outbreak, local people looked for the usual causes of diarrheal illness and didn't find it. And then they sent specimens from people's stools to CDC, and CDC couldn't find any of the usual bugs that cause these illnesses, but had some suspicions. But we didn't have enough data to know what was the cause. And then a few months later, there was a very similar outbreak, and a microbiologist named Joy Wells at CDC said, "I think it's this E. coli 0157 that's in their stool specimens that no one thinks is a pathogen, but I think that's the cause."
All right. What are the symptoms of someone with the bacteria?
So when someone gets sick with E. coli, they get it by somehow getting it into their mouths, and then it sort of, you know, starts to multiply in the bowel, and it does that for 3 or 4 days, and then the person starts by getting non-bloody diarrhea, and then in most of the people who end up seeking medical care, the diarrhea then becomes bloody within a day, and it can be a little bit of blood, or it can look like the stool is all blood, and sometimes the doctors don't think it's a diarrheal illness. They think they're just bleeding from their bowel. The person often has really bad stomach cramps, and women will say it was worse than childbirth, and they'll sometimes have vomiting, nausea. Usually they don't have a high fever, but they feel really, really sick.
Okay, and can it be transferred between people, someone, person to person?
This is a bad bug, and it can be transmitted in a variety of ways, including directly from one person to another. So yes, it can be transmitted by food, by water that's not disinfected, and that includes swimming water, pools, or amusement parks that have water themes that aren't adequately disinfected can transmit it when people get that water in their mouths. People who contact baby animals at petting zoos can get it if they touch anything the animal's feces touched, and then they put their hands in their mouths. And people can get it from one person to another. If you change your baby's diaper and then put your fingers in your mouth, you could get it. And young children can transmit it between themselves. This is a bad bug. Certainly, this bacteria does cause death, and it causes deaths in two main ways. One is that some people develop a type of kidney failure called hemolytic uremic syndrome. And 3 to 5% of those people die with that illness. The other way that people typically die is their bowel disease can be so bad that they can actually get little holes in their bowel, and they can actually die from the bowel disease. That type of death tends to happen much more in elderly people than in anyone else.
Okay. So are there any treatments?
The major treatment, and it's a really important treatment, is supportive care. And that includes making sure that a person with infection, if it's severe, and I'll remind you, there can be more mild illnesses. Some people have non-bloody diarrhea. But if you have severe infection, you want to make sure the person gets enough fluids, and that can help prevent the kidneys from shutting down. We don't know if antibiotics could help with this infection, but there's some very good evidence that certain antibiotics can increase the risk of kidney failure.
Okay. So when I went into my local grocery store and I saw that the romaine lettuce was gone, I saw the CDC, you know, warning there when all, you know, looking at the empty shelves, the first thing I was trying to do is remember when was the last time I had romaine lettuce. And I'm sure that that has made many people very nervous. And I'm wondering, what's the estimated time that romaine lettuce will contain this warning?
So as far as the warnings, we have you covered. There's very clear, and I know you've seen those messages from CDC about what you should do if you don't know what type of lettuce you're about to eat. And there's very clear warnings about romaine lettuce. So we have you covered. And as things change, when it becomes safe, we'll let you know. So that's fine. And as far as romaine lettuce that you might have eaten in the past, the incubation period for this illness is typically 3 or 4 days and not more than 10 days. So I think we're way out on the incubation period. So I think the major thing now is just to heed the warnings.
That was Dr. Patricia Griffin, the Chief of Enteric Diseases at the Epidemiology Branch of CDC. You may not have to worry about eating a bite of lettuce the next time there's an E. coli outbreak. Disease investigators are now able to spot bacteria in food, even before an outbreak, using genome sequencing. This procedure has the CDC's backing. Here to talk more about it is Michael Doyle. He's a retired professor of food microbiology at the University of Georgia. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what is gene sequencing and how is this helping bacteria outbreaks in food?
Well, whole genome sequencing is a relatively new technology that's being used by the Centers for Disease Control and state health departments to basically fingerprint bacteria. And what it does is determine the sequence in which the DNA of the bacteria is arranged. And these bacteria typically have their own sequences and hence are able to be fingerprinted using this technique.
Okay. So how does the CDC do the testing?
Well, most of the testing is actually done by the state health departments. When someone gets sick with salmonellosis or listeria infections or E. coli infections, often go to the doctor, and the lab will then isolate from the patient the bacteria that's causing the illness.
Okay. Are state health departments, are they sending different samples of food and products to be tested? Is that how that works?
No, the state health departments typically will get from the doctor's laboratory the harmful microbe that's causing illness in someone. When someone goes to the doctor's office because they have diarrhea, vomiting, or some form of food poisoning, then the bacteria that's causing it is isolated by the laboratory, and that isolate or strain is sent to the state health lab where they have the more sophisticated equipment for doing the whole genome sequencing.
Can you speak a little bit more on how the FDA would pick specific produce and food companies in order to determine if there will be bacteria in the food exports? Do you have any examples of that?
The food part of this, where food is actually being tested, is typically done for meat and poultry by the USDA, and for all the other foods by FDA. And FDA and USDA will sometimes subcontract sampling and testing out to state health labs or state ag labs, and they'll also go to, for example, grocery stores and take samples and test, as an example, fresh produce for harmful bacteria like Listeria. A classic example is when the Ohio State Health Department or Ag Department went to a store and took a bag of salad mix and tested it for Listeria and found that Listeria was in that package. And then they whole genome sequenced the Listeria, and that information was then sent to the CDC's database, where they then did comparisons of human strains of Listeria that had been sequenced previously, and they made a match. And as a result, they did an investigation, and CDC was able to make a link between the salads and the human infections. Subsequently, FDA went into the processing facility that processed that salad and found that that same strain, based on whole genome sequencing, was in the plant.
I am speaking with Michael Doyle. He is a retired professor of food microbiology at the University of Georgia. Thank you so much, Michael.
You're welcome.
And as we reported at the top of the show, at least one person has died as a result of the E. coli outbreak. This death, reported yesterday, is the first one linked to contaminated romaine lettuce. We're going to continue to follow the story on GPB Radio and online at gpbnews.org. It's On Second Thought. I'm Leah Fleming. A few years ago, I was at my book club meeting with a group of Black women. Several of them are raising boys. And I remember one mother who told us that at the start of every school year, she goes in to meet the teacher with her son. And in a powerful moment, she would look at the white teacher, and they were always often white, but she would look at the teacher in the eye and say, "This is my son. He's an A student, and you will not have any problems with him." Now, this was meant to be more of a warning to the teacher not to mess with her kid. And I share that with you because it speaks to a larger issue that so many parents of color know about. It's something called implicit bias. According to the Kerwin Institute at Ohio State University, the term refers to the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our actions and decisions in an unconscious manner. Now, when it comes to school discipline, implicit bias has been a big problem in Georgia and all across the country. A recent study from the Government Accountability Office finds that Black students are overrepresented when it comes to suspensions, corporal punishment, and school arrests. Michael Tefelsky has been studying the issue for years as a lawyer with the Georgia Legal Services Program, and he joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Thank you.
All right. So a few years ago, you represented a Henry County student who was disciplined much differently than her white classmate. Tell us about that.
Sure. So my client, Makia, she was a sixth grade student at the time, and she had no behavioral problems in the past. She was a star academic student. But she was being bullied on social media by another student who was white, and Makia's Black. And on this day, the white student had pressured her to skip class, and the girls skipped class, and they went into the girls' locker room. The white student had a Sharpie and began to do some damage in the locker room that was pretty significant. She hands the marker to my client and says, "Here, now you need to write something." And my client writes, H-I, on a bathroom stall. And they get caught doing this, and they both admit to their involvement. And the disparity really occurred in how they were treated after this behavior. And my client, Makia, she was sent to a disciplinary hearing where she faced permanent expulsion from school for this infraction. She was required to retain an attorney, and a few weeks later, a deputy arrived at her house and served her with a delinquency petition, where she had to then appear in juvenile court and also retain an attorney. The white student, on the other hand, was able to pay $100 and go on with her life. She didn't have to retain an attorney. She wasn't sent to a disciplinary tribunal. She didn't face any sort of permanent expulsion from school. She didn't face any criminal consequences. He, on the other hand, had to serve probation. She had to do community service. She was so young at the time, we couldn't even find anyone that would take her to do the community service. So we were fortunate to have Senator Jones, who represents Henry County, and he welcomed her to the Capitol, and she was able to do her community service there. But otherwise, we might not have been able to even find anywhere where she could serve it because she was so young. And it was an eye-opening experience for me and really has shaped, you know, my advocacy and work that we do now on behalf of students.
Mm. Now, that experience, it's representative of a lot of experience, I think, of people of color. And you've had a chance to really study the trends at the local level in different communities here in Georgia. What are some of the disparities that you all have noticed?
We review data every year across the state from different school districts in Georgia, and we see those stark race disparities and also disparities in how students with disabilities are disciplined in school. And that ranges from in-school suspensions, out-of-school suspensions, expulsions, corporal punishment, which still exists in Georgia. Many people don't know. Black children are 3 times as likely to receive corporal punishment than white children.
You're talking about spankings?
Yeah, paddling.
Paddling,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and the race disparities are stark. But we try to drive down into the real weeds of the data, and you see where the disparities really become stark is looking at these sort of subjective offenses. And that's where we believe the implicit bias, and I think the research supports that the implicit bias really impacts decision-making of school teachers and administrators.
The Georgia Supreme Court recently ruled against this idea of zero-tolerance discipline in schools. And I know that you have dealt with a case involving that at the Supreme Court level. Talk a little bit about that and what effects could the ruling actually have.
Last year, the Georgia Supreme Court ruled in the first-ever school discipline case that came up to the Supreme Court. It was a zero-tolerance case where a student was expelled, a senior in high school, for fighting, but she was acting in self-defense. And so the court ruled that a zero-tolerance fighting policy that doesn't take into account whether a student was acting in self-defense is not consistent with Georgia law and would be unlawful. Mm-hmm. So it has an impact on implicit bias because we know there's a deep correlation between school districts that enforce zero-tolerance policies and schools that have huge race disparities. Because with zero-tolerance policies, you're often talking about sort of rush decisions without a lot of thought or investigation as to what might be the cause of the misbehavior, or if there is even a misbehavior, like in our case where we had a student who was a victim of bullying and responded back. So that case, I think, is the first step towards our pursuit for ending zero tolerance in schools and using legal advocacy as a way to do that.
I want to play this clip from Deshaw Hockett. He's a founder of this social justice organization called Safe Places for the Advancement of Community and Equity. And he described the problem of implicit bias, especially in education, during a TED Talk last year.
The science of implicit bias says that you can be a school administrator and say that you are deeply committed to nurturing and building up young people, and yet be the same school administrator who leads your school in high rates of suspensions and expulsions of young people. Consciously, you're deeply committed to building young people up. Unconsciously, you're doing harm in the process.
So, Michael, if that is the case, then how do we begin to even address this problem, considering it can be so difficult to even identify?
I think first we need to just acknowledge that a problem exists, and that can be a very difficult hurdle for many people in power structures to realize. And so I think once we overcome that, then we can start to plan a way in which we can improve the situation for students. And one way is to just simply look at a student handbook and look for these subjective offenses, these sort of vague, overly broad offenses, because we know that the data shows that the disparities exist with these infractions. And so looking at ways that we can better improve the writing of these student handbooks is one way.
Michael Tefelsky is a lawyer with the Georgia Legal Services Program. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We just talked about corporal punishment in schools. Georgia is one of 23 states where some form of corporal punishment is still allowed. Rebecca Ryan is a psychology professor at Georgetown University who has studied corporal punishment. She did a study showing that fewer parents are spanking their children. She talked about her findings with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley.
We started looking at parents' reported rates of spanking and endorsing spanking their children back in 1988. And we looked at it from 1988 to 2011 and have shown a dramatic reduction in the proportion of parents of kindergarten age kids who say they would spank their kids, and a dramatic reduction of those who said they had spanked their kid in the past week.
So do we know why?
That's the million-dollar question. There's a lot of reasons why this could be happening. One is that we also found a dramatic increase in the share of parents who are saying that they would and have given their children non-corporal punishment discipline strategies like timeouts. That the rate of parents endorsing timeouts increased greatly over that same period. So partly, I think parents are just figuring out other things to do. Rather than spank their children, they're being given options and they're taking those options, perhaps because they feel like those options are more effective.
So we have a message from Jennifer Feichner. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, Jennifer, on Facebook, who says, as an early childhood educator, the research is clear. In and out of the home, the effects of corporal punishment are negative for children and lead to worse outcomes. So in the minute that we have left, Rebecca, as far as you're concerned, it's certainly in terms of both the child's development and trying to get the right behavior out of them, corporal punishment doesn't work?
Yeah, I would say that that's what the science suggests.
And positive reinforcement, meaning rewards and incentives, does.
It does. Right now, we think, I mean, timeouts, when done effectively, can be very useful. But positive reinforcement for good behavior is really one of the best strategies that we have as parents and educators.
That's Georgetown University professor Rebecca Ryan speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. If you're a fan of NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts, then you've probably heard Tank and the Bangas. The New Orleans group won last year's NPR Tiny Desk Contest. Well, now they're headed to Atlanta for a performance later this month. GPB's Sean Powers caught up with the lead singer.
My name is Tariana Tank Ball, and I am the lead singer of Tank and the Bangas, and we are from New Orleans, Louisiana.
The moment you tie your own shoes, or spelled your name in your alphabet soup, or told your mom that you're walking to the bus stop by yourself. Don't talk to strangers.
I started mixing in music with my poetry because I guess I was born in New Orleans, and being around people like Asia Rainey and Sonny Patterson and Catalyst and Icon the artist, we always mixed our music with our poetry because it was where we were from. There is a piece that I go back to my experiences with my experience with Katrina.
The story is breaking at this hour. Hurricane Katrina, the monster storm bearing down on New Orleans, coastal Mississippi, and coastal Alabama. Katrina downgraded.
I think about my grandma's house a lot and how safe and awesome it felt. And I go through the emotions of literally crawling through a window just to get inside her home. And I've never had to do that before. And going in her home and seeing it absolutely ripped apart and thinking about the fact that my grandma wanted to stay in New Orleans and we convinced her to leave with us, and how she would have died if she would have stayed. Well, it's a poem and it starts off, it was a direct hit. The splash went smash. The house crumbled beneath the weight. There's water, water everywhere and not a drop to drink. I miss my grandmother's house. She had the type of neighborhood that would have grandchildren swarming like bees, hoping to lick the nectar of 25-cent frozen cups from Miss Ella down the street. Wasn't no such thing as the flavor of strawberry. You see, we lived in color. Like, can I have a red, please? I remember getting up early to Christian Union Baptist Church where my grandfather, Reverend Bradford, was the pastor. Cranberry juice and communion crackers, Chris the ushers, and my grandmama at the door. But grandmama is not here no more, and no longer is her home. And at least when grandparents would leave, we would still have their homes. The scent of their recipes still cooking on them stoves. And some people still ask us why we sing those Wade in the Water songs or why we write those Katrina poems, because I still miss my grandmother's house. I think that the storm touched with my music or influenced my music in a way of how important it is to feel home even when you're not there, to remember things that are special to you that only New Orleans people can know about. If anybody ever forgot to tell you, you are important. You are special even. Your body was made especially extravagant, extra human. The backstory behind human was just feeling really impossible one day. And I remember listening to a poet say, if you break down the word impossible, I'm possible. I think it's so true. When people say stuff like, I'm just human. I mean, what do you expect from me? I'm just human. I think that's a cop-out. Like, this is an incredible thing to be. This is an incredible person to be. This is a living thing. And when you watch the Olympics and when you see singers and actors remember a million lines, to be human is to be an incredible life force. Don't weaken it.
You should play with him. I'm sure your attention won't cause a deficient amount in nerve cells. Us women, we blink nearly twice as much as men, so keep looking. She'll notice you. May take her a little longer, but she's got to. The average human heart will beat over 1 million times in one lifetime. I am sure you'll find someone who won't mind skipping one for you.
I see Tank and Vegas. In New Orleans, I haven't seen a woman head a group of guys like this in a long time. And New Orleans needs that. New Orleans needs the next amazing group of creativity coming out and sharing it with the world so they could know what goes on down here. It's important. It's special, and it always has been. And I'm excited for people to see that. It's dope to be a gutsy chick. It really is. To say some of the things I say or you say and do it, it's dope. And it feels free. And that is the only way to live this life.
It's so beautiful, special.
That's Tariana Tank Ball. She's lead singer of the New Orleans band Tank and the Bangas. The group performs May 18th at Atlanta's Terminal West. Details are at gpbnews.org. And just a programming note, this year's Tiny Desk winner is a Georgia native, Naya Azumi. We'll bring you his story next week. It's On Second Thought. I'm Leah Fleming. Tomorrow we introduce an unsung hero of the civil rights movement. Her name was Georgia Gilmore. She sold baked goods and beauty salons to raise money to finance the Montgomery bus boycott. If you know of an unsung civil rights hero that we should feature on the show, then we want to hear from you. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter or Facebook. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. When he was elected as Atlanta's mayor in 1973, the late Maynard Jackson became the first African-American mayor of a major southern city. He was best known for strengthening the black middle class and creating scores of black millionaires.
Reorganization of our city government will be designed to open wide the doors of City Hall to all Atlantans and to make our city government more responsive to people needs and people problems.
During his three terms in office, Jackson created affirmative action programs, helped secure Atlanta as host city to the 1996 Olympics, and expanded what's now named Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. A new documentary about his legacy is showing this week in Atlanta. It's called Maynard, The Man, The Politician, The Game Changer. With us to talk about it is his son, Maynard Jackson III, and his wife, Wendy Jackson. Both are executive producers of the film. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
All right, so Maynard Jackson became the first black mayor of Atlanta, and that brought both praise as well as apprehension among many Atlantans, as he noted in this clip.
All of a sudden, I became the mayor not just of Atlanta, but of the black people in Georgia and even some neighboring states. Now, equally important and equally difficult was what we found in the white community. Exaggerated anxiety. That anxiety was, oh my God, what are we going to do? We got a black mayor. What does this mean? Is this the end of Atlanta?
What were the biggest struggles, would you say, Maynard was met with, your father?
Biggest struggles, I'd say, maybe people being so set back, you know, kind of startled by his forthrightness.
Yeah.
And just stepping up to the helm and stepping into leadership.
Yeah.
I think that brushed people. You know, Vernon Jordan says, to the elders, that was a bit brazen. You know, I love the way he said that.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Wendy, as you were working through this documentary and that kind of thing?
I think one of his biggest challenges was of something that Jackson Ransom, his first wife, talks about in the film is that he comes into office as mayor in 1973, and his challenge was to make everything black people thought he was going to, you know, make all the problems go away, much like President Barack Obama. And that was a challenge because that's a lot of pressure. But Maynard loved this city, and he wanted equality and economic opportunity for everyone. And that was a challenge because we were still considered the Confederate South. Mm-hmm. In many, many ways, you still had relics of the old way of thinking. And there was a big changing of the guard. 73 was a pivotal year because you had not only the election of Maynard Jackson in the South, but you had Tom Bradley out in California. You had Carl Stokes. So it was a time where our entire nation was going through change. But for Maynard to become the game changer of the South, he was met by old practices and old ways of doing things, and he defied that. So as my husband always says, his dad used to tell him, leadership required making people happy and some people happy and some people unhappy. He had a whole lot of unhappy.
Unhappy, yeah, even among his own people of
right.
color. Yeah,
right.
Sure.
Atlanta, Georgia has the widest income gap between rich and poor of all the major U.S. cities, according to the latest U.S. Census. The Brookings Institution reported Atlanta as one of the top cities to exhibit the highest rates of income inequality in 2016. People of color are most affected by that, as you know. Your father cared deeply for building a strong middle class in Atlanta. What do you think he'd say now?
He would be very interested in bridging that gap. He was very much a man of the people. You know, he ate with kings and had the common touch as well. You know we would go for drives on Sunday afternoon, and we couldn't get, you know, past the city block without him pulling over and shaking people's hand. You know, Andy Patterson just joked with us that he'd hate walking down the street with Maynard because it'd take an hour to walk a block.
Because he was a person of the people, I think that there's, you know, Atlanta has grown from, you know, in Maynard's last iteration as mayor, we've grown substantially.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were drawn to Atlanta for different reasons. The Olympics brought a lot of people here, and they made Atlanta their home. The tragedy of those that were affected by Hurricane Katrina, and they've stayed and made Atlanta their home. But one of the things that made Atlanta such a viable place for economic opportunity is that we had more HBCUs in Atlanta than any other place. We also have a high level of corporations here that have people of color at the helm. I think he would try to create programs. Everybody doesn't want to go to a college or a four-year institution, and that's fine, but there should be adequate training for those that don't. So to help people find their dream mm-hmm. and to live that, I think that he would be very much a part of the organic groundswell of the people of Atlanta he would listen to them to find out what their needs are and find very strategic, brilliant ways of being able to bridge that gulf that has been growing ever since that time. So the population of Atlanta has expanded tremendously.
Yeah.
And some of those persons weren't necessarily prosperous when they got here. So in looking for the promise and looking for that hope, and I think as the city continued to grow, I think that he would be looking to create programs to help those people realize their dreams. Mm-hmm.
One of Maynard's biggest accomplishments was expanding the Atlanta International Airport, Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, and it's known as the world's busiest airport in large part due to him. And in your film, you use a clip from the Delta CEO at the time, Leo Mullen, speaking on behalf of Maynard and his great accomplishments at the airport. I want to listen to a piece of that.
During his mayoral terms, Maynard championed minority hiring, of which there was precious little at the time. Using the clout of government contracts, he helped develop minority involvement that had never before existed and might not exist today had he not been so forceful.
Why was it so important for him to include minority contracts in this process?
You know, Maynard was a person for, definitely he was all people, but where else in the country did minorities and women actually have a chance for economic opportunity? So being that, Atlanta has had a high population of people that wanted change, they wanted to see results, they wanted to make their dreams come true, he understood he could see beyond the curve. That was a huge undertaking. And as he shared with them, you can park your airplane someplace else if you're not going to be inclusive of people, of people of color and women. Figure it out someplace else. But if you're going to do it here, we're going to do it. We're going to operate inclusively. And he didn't compromise on that.
Mm. I'm talking with Maynard Jackson III, executive producer of the new film Maynard, the Man, the Politician, the Game Changer. And we're also joined by his wife, Wendy Jackson, the filmmaker of the documentary. During his second term in office, the Atlanta child murders were going on, and there were many private donations, and he was able to raise about $100,000 as a reward to anyone who had concrete evidence as to who was the killer.
The one thing I remember most about the missing and murdered children is Maynard Jackson sitting there with piles of cash, offering a reward for any information on who was committing these crimes.
During this time, Maynard, you were a kid yourself. Right. And I'm wondering what your memories were. Do you remember your parents even being worried about you being abducted? And, you know, what were your memories of that?
There was always a police officer at the house. But that was normal, but it was always more than one. It was a big deal for me to go out on my bike all of a sudden and do what I was used to doing, you know, riding around the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So, I remember being annoyed by that, but I knew what was going on, so I understood.
What did you all learn about Maynard during that time? Because I think I've seen the documentary. I think it really affected him deeply.
Oh, he did. As a matter of fact, if you, just from a journalistic point of view, if you try to pull footage and articles and things of that nature, it's not that he went quiet, because he wasn't quiet, but you could even look in pictures. His demeanor and everything was affected. I think he was something that you couldn't control. He wasn't a law enforcement officer, but how do I outthink this? How can I get in front of this? How can I find a way to have more active people on the street so we can find the killer? And, you know, as a parent, so you're thinking always twofold. You're thinking about the people in the city of Atlanta, and you're also thinking, I have a son, too. I have kids, too. And he cared. And, you know, Atlanta, you have all of these stories about serial killers, but now this has come to your home, and it was happening for years before someone was caught. So it was a very a very sad chapter for our city.
Yeah. You know, the documentary, it's laced with all kinds of personal moments about his love life. He found love twice, mm-hmm. with your mother, and then with his second wife. It also talks about his relationship with food, his love of food. There were some just plenty of lighthearted moments in this documentary. And I'm wondering, you know, as you reflect on his legacy, is that something that you really want people to know about him?
Well, we wanted people to get to know him as a person, as a father, as a human who had faults, strengths and faults. So our director, Sam Pollard, wanted to be able to deliver a well-rounded film. And, you know, and when I look back from us, you know, from the time we started and just all these different shoots, you know, it's each one is a story arc into the other one. And for me, it was a therapeutic process.
How so?
Well, just dealing with processing, grieving, you know. I find personally it's an ongoing process. I don't think we ever get over it. Wendy can attest to that as well. But yeah, you know, especially the interview process when Sam interviewed me. But the whole documentary.
We had to interview him twice.
Okay.
We interviewed him. We interviewed him twice. The first time, you know, it takes a while to
break the shell. I crack that shell.
Our director was like, he's not. It wasn't about being honest. He just wanted him to just really deal with his feelings. He was able to do that. I think it's been a cathartic not as a daughter-in-law, but as a producer, I can see that it's been a very cathartic process for everyone. And there's, you know, there's a lot of people that loved Maynard very much and, you know, others wanting to do subsequent documentaries about his life. But let me share this with you. And as a storyteller myself, the one thing I'm able to observe is this. Maynard made his biggest gift was making you feel like you were the absolute most important person. I mean, he shared that the connection was undeniable. But, you know, if you think about, he gave more than he got. I have run across, you know, people that have felt very entitled, almost like he was a product in the making of this, you know. I deserve to be in it. I'm thinking to myself, the one thing that we didn't put out there, and we're going to do a subsequent documentary about, is Maynard in his own words, because you get to understand who he was and what his thoughts were. So you might be the person that he gave instruction to or he spoke with, but with his heart, who were those persons that he trusted with his heart? And that group is a very, very small niche group that made it on camera.
That's who we saw on camera.
You saw those persons on camera.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we got the best of Maynard in this documentary. It is it's not about all the Wikipedia things that he did, because if we wanted to and the funds were there, we could unlock the film and have 10 minutes of credits of all of his accomplishments and things that he's done. Mm-hmm. But we wanted you to know that here's a kid that lost his father at 15. His mama had 6 kids. His grandparents, like many of us, grandparents intervene and to help, and aunts intervene and help raise you and mold you. We wanted to make him someone that was relatable, therefore can be inspirational to those that see the documentary, young people saying, you know, he did it, I can do it too.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this film, you know, so people can learn stuff like that, but more to the point, so they could get to know the man.
That was Maynard Jackson III and Wendy Jackson, both executive producers of the new film Maynard, the Man, the Politician, the Game Changer. You can see it on May 4th at 4:45 p.m. at the Plaza Theater in Atlanta. Details are at gpbnews.org. And before we go, here is a little more from Maynard Jackson, the night he became Atlanta's mayor.
Regardless of where we live in Atlanta, whether it be Buckhead or Beaver Slide, Peachtree Hills or Perry Homes, Cabbage Town or Collier Heights, Carver Homes or Cascade Heights, regardless of what one does for a living, regardless of the insularity one's money may afford, everybody is crime's victim. And we all must make certain that this dread disease does not cause our great city's demise.
That's the voice of the late Maynard Jackson, the former mayor of Atlanta. And that's our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. We talked earlier about corporal punishment in schools. Do you think that it should be allowed? Tell us why. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. Or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Maura Curry, Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and Tanya Ott is the executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to our interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. The theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Leah Fleming. Have a great day.